today's program, we're ending the search with teacher and spiritual director Dorothy Hunt. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Welcome to the program. You know, many books about the spiritual journey imply that we are heading somewhere. But spiritual teacher and psychotherapist Dorothy Hunt's new book, Ending the Search, helps us relax our efforts to arrive at a future destination and guides us to return home to the ever-present heart of awareness that resides within each of us. Ending the Search demystifies the paradox of spiritual exploration by showing us that our egoic ambition to achieve a future goal actually moves us away from experiencing the peace, clarity, freedom, and love that are present now when we stop to notice. By incorporating the self-inquiry practices provided in this book, we're invited to move beyond traditional ideas surrounding self-growth and to discover the true identity of the I that we imagine is separate from the truth we seek. Dorothy Hunt serves as spiritual director of Moon Mountain Sangha and is the founder of the San Francisco Center for Meditation and Psychotherapy. She's the author of Only This and Leaves from Moon Mountain, as well as being a contributing author of two volumes on non-dual wisdom and psychotherapy. Dorothy was invited by her spiritual teacher, Adishanti, to teach within his lineage. And today, Dorothy's teaching points beyond ideas, religions, or practices to the sheer mystery that is always right here behind and within this moment as it is. It's an honor to have her on today's program, and she's joining us from beautiful San Francisco. Dorothy Hunt, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
You know, I have to start out, we were talking a little bit earlier. You are from originally Indiana.
I am. I was born and raised in Indianapolis.
What high school did you attend?
Thomas Carr Howe High School.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I just drove by there a couple days ago. And I think you told me you went to DePaul University in Greencastle.
Yes, I did. I did. Yeah, and that's where I met my husband, although he was also from Indianapolis and went to Tech High School.
Okay.
Way back when.
Yeah, way back when. And then, of course, later, then you ended up in San Francisco.
And we did.
You've been in that area for some time now, haven't you?
Yes, I have since 1967.
Okay. Well,
tells you what an old lady I am.
Speaking of the past, I really want to start there. This new book is wonderful, Ending the Search, From Spiritual Ambition to the Heart of Awareness. And I'd like to ask you about your spiritual journey, where it began, I'm sure at an early age, and then how it unfolded.
I wouldn't have known it at the time, but I think it really began with the death of my mother when I was 12. She died the day after Christmas, and her birthday was going to be on Easter that following year. So I was born, raised in a Christian family, and I felt like I certainly had faith as big as a mustard seed, as the Bible says, couldn't move mountains. So I prayed deeply that she would be resurrected on Easter, like Jesus. That was my childhood fantasy. And of course, that did not happen. So I was very angry with God because it was told to me that that's who gave life and took it away. So I was not at that point, you know, searching for myself or truth or any of the things that came later, but I really wanted to know God because I was so mad and felt betrayed. And so that was kind of the beginning of the search without my really knowing it, but it opened up those big questions of birth, life, and death at an early age. And so there was some grace in that as I look back at this point, at any rate. And then, you know, I was interested in meditation as I got older, and there was very little about that in the Christian church where I went.
Yes.
And there was a moment of silence, which if you've ever been in a Protestant church, is just that. It's like 30 seconds, maybe max. But somehow, right there, you know, the silence of the place and stained glass window really just touched me somehow. So, you know, read a little book about meditation. Said you, if you were in the Christian tradition, you could contemplate a Bible verse. So I did. It was, "Be still and know that I am God." And I just would say those words, but really feeling into what is it like to just be, or to be still, or to be still and know that. And then, you know, we could fast forward through other types of meditation and so forth, but then there was a moment where I had a dream of Ramana Maharshi, who was a sage in India who died in 1950. I had no idea who this person was who showed up in my dream, whether he was dead or alive, or what he taught. But the radiance and love on that face knew I had to find out something about him. So I got a book, The Spiritual Teachings of Ramana Maharshi, and his path to awakening really was a lot about self-inquiry, that question, who am I, or who or what am I? And so I just began doing that for a few years, actually, just spontaneously. It wasn't like sitting on a cushion and some intellectual, who am I, who am I, who am I? You know, it was more like, by that time I was working as a psychotherapist, I was married, had kids, but I would just inquire, well, who's sitting with her client right now? Who's looking at herself in the mirror? Who is this that's feeling angry or sad or whatever was the moment? And as any of you know, or your listeners know, who've tried self-inquiry for a while, there comes a point where you just come to, I don't know, because there's something that's still here that has observed your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations, everything that arises still has something in you that's conscious and awake to that. And so that question eventually can dissolve the questioner, which is what happened in my case. There was just a moment in time where there was just such an opening to the deepest possible truth of the oneness of being and how all of us are that. Like, there's no separate one to be enlightened or to be awakened, unlike the mind imagines, because we just see that that is who and what everything is. And so that was a moment that just, you know, I felt like, well, I could die happy, you know. that was the culmination of the spiritual search, I thought, until a few years later I met my teacher, Ajahn Shanti, who came from the Zen background. And we both spoke at the same conference, and when he began speaking, I just knew there was some transmission that I needed. And so very, very shortly, I was invited to attend a retreat with him. And what came from that really was this understanding that awakening to the absolute nature of being is just halfway around the circle. You know, a lot of traditions seem as though that's the end point, but actually it turns out it's just the beginning. Because how does this awaken us? Now, how does it want to be embodied? How does it want to live its life through us, through human experience, you know? Because for me, anyway, the divine is here having a human experience. And so when we understand that or feel it or sense it in ourselves, then there's an opening more and more to how does this want to live, how does it want to love, how does it want to express itself, actually moment to moment. So that's the short but not so short version of this.
It almost sounds like, and I don't know if you felt this, but as if the divine was calling you to meditation.
Yes. I think that the spiritual search begins with what we're hoping to find, because that's what touches us someplace inside and calls us to the search.
I remember there was a point in my life when I was reading so many books. I had a master's in counseling, ordained minister. I, too, was in the more conservative Protestant church for years, left that quite some time ago now, where this little, I didn't consider it a profound insight, but one day I thought, you know, this whole spiritual and personal development stuff is overrated. Isn't it really all about remembrance?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sense I got from your teaching and from this specific book.
Yes, yes. We're not finding something new. We're remembering what we've always been. And therefore, the search, I think, begins to crank itself up, we might say, when we start looking within instead of only looking without.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything is this mystery, by whatever name we call it. And certainly, you know, whatever we see is an expression of that. But so often the mind is looking for something it thinks it doesn't have. But actually, you know, our longing, if we follow it back to its source, you know, will show us a great deal about who we are.
Mm-hmm. We seem to be wired, I think, to be seeking mechanisms, and often it totally exhausts us.
Yeah.
When or how was the end of seeking? How did that happen for you?
Well, it was on a private retreat. No teacher. I was just by myself in a retreat center in nature, and I just had this experience of, you know, everything getting more and more quiet and not so many thoughts. But then there would always be this idea, oh, maybe something big is going to happen, you know. And you know how the mind can do that.
Yes.
At any rate, it was a Vedanta retreat center, and I, you know, I'm not a devotee of Ramakrishna, and yet his picture was in the meditation hall of this particular place. And so I was meditating one night, and somehow it seemed as though that personage, you know, kind of came out of this picture and said, you know, devote yourself to the Divine Mother, you know, something important is going to happen at 10 o'clock. And of course, I thought, oh my gosh, maybe this is it, do you know? And they said, you have to stay awake and meditate till 10. Well, I had no question that I could do that. Do you know that little ego mind can think it's in control of everything? But at any rate, what happened, you know, I was meditating madly, and then I was not awake. I don't know what happened. It seemed as though, you know, whether it was a dream or whatever, you know, that this figure came over and put a finger between my eyes, and boom, I was unconscious. Now, it could have been a dream. I don't know. It's not so important. Mm-hmm. But the important part was that I woke up quite a bit after 10. And at first, I was really angry. You know, like I felt like, why did you set me up like this? You know, you know. And then I just started laughing. You know, like, oh my gosh, I'm not in charge. I'm just not in charge as this little ego. And so I went to bed kind of with a smile on my face. And the next morning, I was just open. You know, it's kind of like I said to the universe or to the divine, "What's my lesson for today?" And then there was just this inner knowing, you know, that seemed to come, that time and space were simply constructs that were created so that this that we are could see itself, could love itself.
Mm.
And it wasn't an intellectual. It was just this deep, deep knowing that then just saw the oneness of everything. And there was a lot of joy and relief and tears and gratitude and just seeing myself, the capital S, in everything I saw. So that was the end of the seeking.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I felt like I wasn't searching anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we don't have a whole lot to do after that, you know, in terms of you know, embodying the infinite. How could that ever end, you know?
Exactly.
How could there ever be an end to that?
Exactly. Yeah, I remember when I was in the church that we would often have our answers for almost everything.
Yeah.
And then when I left all of that and then started diving deep into non-duality teaching, there was a word that would often come up from teachers, but also within myself, and I've learned to embrace this word. It's become so beautiful, and I'd like for you to speak to it, and that is just embracing the mystery of it all.
Yes, well, it is a mystery, and we don't bump into it through our thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We bump into it in silence, really. You know, Rumi has a lot of lovely poems, and one that I'm somewhat familiar with called Send the Chaperones Away, but there's a part in it that says, silence is an ocean, speech is a river. When the ocean's searching for you, don't walk to the language river, listen to the ocean. And it feels like that's what we discover when we listen that deeply. There is no way that a mind could describe what's there. There's no way, there's no words. It's like, you know, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. It's that sort of experience where you know when you are aware of that empty mystery, whatever. It's not empty in the sense of the mind thinking of emptiness. It's empty of definition, right? It's empty of self. It's empty of conflict. It's empty of lots of things, because it's this infinite potential, and there's never, from my perspective anyway, we can never again say, I know what that is, but that knows itself. And when that wakes up to itself in any of us, regardless of tradition or no tradition, I do think that, you know, when we become a little bit wiser, we realize we don't know, and yet there is something that's known and remembered. And what is that? Call it any name you like, but it's not the name.
I found that when I started embracing that more in my own personal journey, that I began to experience greater peace, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Indeed, because this is at peace. You mm-hmm. know, even though it expresses itself as life and you and me and your listeners, you know, moment to moment, in itself, it's not threatened by anything that threatens our conditioned mind. Mm-hmm. And so it is where we find that peace that passeth understanding,
yeah.
as the Bible would say.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's right there within each of us.
So, Dorothy, what do you say to the listeners now who are listening to this show, they're listening to so many other podcasts out there and reading countless and countless books, many of them wonderful books.
We do, yeah.
But they're seeking, and they're continuing to seek, and now you're talking about ending the search.
I would invite anyone who's interested or who feels moved to really get curious about who the seeker is.
Hmm.
You know, we all think we know who we are. You know, we were born at a certain date, and we had this and that experience. All of those things that we haul out from memory to define us. But you know, when you really get curious, are you just those thoughts, those memories, this body? Is that the whole of you? Do you know? And just to get curious about the seeker or the doubter. You know, a lot of people have experiences of the vastness or the mystery. Do you know, it seems wonderful when it's, you know, when those moments are there, and then they feel like they've lost it because the experience changes. But as we know, experiences will always come and go.
Yeah.
But there's something that doesn't come and go in each of our lives. And what is that? Do you know, and it feels like there's something that's been awake and aware in each of us from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so close, we don't even notice. It's so, you know, they say, nearer than the breath, nearer than yourself. You know, it's subtle, this awake and aware in us, but it actually holds the key to our liberation, to get really curious about what that is that seems to be, you know, prior to thought, prior to emotion, prior to sensation, because it's what sees it. So I think it was St. Francis of Assisi who said, you know, what you're looking for is what is looking. So to become interested in what's looking, you know, what's seeing, what's aware, what's awake.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. Out there searching, and then we come to this realization, hopefully we come to this realization that we are the home, we're already home.
Already home, absolutely, already home.
Speak to the practice of self-inquiry, importance of that.
Well, it isn't for everyone, because a lot of people will just feel like it's an intellectual exercise and it doesn't take me any place and blah, blah, blah. But it actually is a practice that can melt our separation from what we truly are, because we're inviting our mind to try to find its source. And as I said earlier, you know, there will be a time where we can't go any further, because the mind of thought, just lives in time. It lives in duality, which is not a mistake. It's just the way the mind. I'm talking about the mind of thought, not big mind in a Buddhist sense. But you know, the mind of thought can only take us so far. It can take us to the edge of the known, and beyond that, there's this unknown mystery that we were speaking about just a moment ago. Mm. And so when we get to that point, at some time or place, by grace and our own deep desire to know, we can stay looking into the unknown and see, you know, what might want to reveal itself in that silence, in that ocean of awareness.
Dorothy also writes that the what questions when you're practicing self-inquiry are more helpful than the how or why questions.
Yes.
Explain.
Well, if I were to ask you or your listeners right now, like, you know, what does awakeness feel like in your toes, in your feet right now? You know, probably many people, if they really inquire what does it feel like right now in my body, we'll find you'll feel a sense of energy. Something will perhaps wake up a bit. And if I say, well, how do I feel this in my feet? See, now that's a mind question. And the mind maybe will come up with some answers, but we're not going to find it in thought. And so, you know, what does this awakeness feel like in my heart? What does it feel like in my body? What does it feel like in my mind? Because, of course, there is this deep truth of it's empty of definition, but it's the openness of our mind, the openness of our heart. The presence is another word we could use. The presence to be here for what's here. And so, you know, even as we're living, trying to live more and more from the deeper truths that we have discovered, you know, it's like, what does this moment want, rather than how do I deal with this moment?
Yeah.
Those kind of things just, I think, invite a deeper knowing.
Yeah, so that question I asked you, for some reason, I'm thinking in my head, one of my favorite teachers who passed away long ago, Dr. Leo Buscaglia, talked about love and life in his class at USC, when they would sit around, and of course he used the term rap about love, and someone would have an insight, they would shout, insight, and then everyone would stop. So I had a little insight in
what
the sense that, well, when you ask the question why, it engages your mind, you're in your head.
Yes. Yeah.
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 Simple.
Exactly.
You also write, in a true question, the answer is already present. It kind of reminds me of something that I've thought of before. Actually, someone else probably shared it with me, and that is, if you're asking the question, you already have the answer.
Yes, because once again, if we go back to the inquiry issue, you see, who's asking? I mean, we're talking about existential questions now.
Yes.
Not, you know, why did my cake fall in the oven last time?
Exactly.
You know, there are answers to why questions, for sure. But we're talking here about the deep existential one. You know, what is life? What is death? What is love? What is truth? What is God? What is self? You know, those kind of questions come right out of the what I call the heart of awareness, which is this mystery that actually is present in all of us. That's the inseparability of truth and love. You know, a lot of people will just point to the awareness part, but it feels like when this that's awake in us, when it really starts to move, because it's seeing itself, there's love there. You know, it moves as love, even though in itself we might not be able to make any definition,
yes,
you know, for this.
Yeah. I love the subtitle of this book, From Spiritual Ambition to the Heart of Awareness. And you write in the book that this is really a journey into the heart's cave. And I loved that imagery, the heart's cave. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's that, even though once we discover it, we realize it's everywhere. But in our human experience, I think that deep place of the unknown, you know, a cave is dark, isn't it? It's a place where we may be a little bit afraid to go. A lot of people are afraid in the spiritual journey, you know. They want something that's going to be good for the me. And this is about kind of seeing through the me, the transparency of what we've taken ourselves to be. So that cave is that place that is, how would I put it? In my experience, for a long time, it was this place that was just reserved for the divine, you know. And the very first time that opened up to a human being, I was with a friend and we were meditating together, and that just opened up, and I let that friend in, so to speak, was the feeling. And then I was just furious with myself. I felt like, you know, I shouldn't have done that. This is a place that was only reserved for the divine, because of course at that moment I had a real separation going there, you know. And then, you know, I was in a group situation and I opened my eyes after I had felt so vulnerable and like I'd made such a big mistake by letting somebody in there. And then I realized, oh no, everything belongs there. Everything belongs inside that. But for a while, it's a very private place, you know, and it's a very, well, Ramana Maharshi used to meditate by saying, you know, enter with love the temple that is your own heart.
Yes.
And that temple is what is the cave of the heart, you know. It's that place that's no place, and yet we can feel it. It's like our home ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I ask anyone, well, can you just go to your home ground? I can't tell you how or where, but you know. And then, you know, there's that sense that a lot of people will have of that felt sense of our home ground within ourselves.
Something that I've always been fascinated by is what I call dream time. Having Robert Moss on this program maybe 8 or 9 times, great dream expert, and Coleman Barks, when he came on to talk about Rumi, that talked about all the dreams and all the dream journals he still writes in. Mm-hmm. I'm still fascinated by your experience when you were beginning to wean away, I guess, from the Christian background, and Ramana Maharshi showed up in a dream. You didn't even know who he was.
Not consciously, no.
No, not consciously. And I find that so powerful. The Indian teachers, what is it about them and impacting your life in such a profound way? What's the connection there?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that each of us come in with what I would call a certain mind stream, and that mind stream has connected from way back, you know, in terms of how life unfolds. I at this point I don't think of karma as being a personal thing, but there is cause and effect. There's causes and conditions. And so, you know, when we've had some kind of connection to something, and it doesn't have to be a spiritual thing. It could be music or physics or, you know, or sports or whatever, whether it comes in genetically or it comes in just on consciousness itself, you know, I'm not able to say, but I do think that, you know, we probably have had that connection with these people, places, or things that seem to touch us so profoundly. And sometimes that appears in a dream, and it's just a mystery how those things come together in life to me, and yet they seem to.
To go deep, how important is it for someone to have a guru or a spiritual teacher?
Well, it depends on who you speak to.
Right.
I mean, Ramana Maharshi's guru was a mountain, so it doesn't have to be a person. And actually, the true guru lives inside, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if an outer guru is needed, the inner guru just calls one forth. So eventually we discover that the true spiritual teacher is inside each of us. It's the wisdom and the love and the deep knowing that each of us have if we're quiet enough to listen, you know, that still small voice, you know, it's inside of us.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm not here to say everyone needs a guru, but I do think that if we do need a teacher, that one will appear if we're sincere seekers. A lot of people are just seeking a teacher rather than really seeking truth. So I think that there's a certain maturation process that happens in our spirituality, just like intellectually and emotionally and all the rest.
Yes, yes. Do you have your book with you?
I do.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a favor because at the very end of your book, and it's quite long, but you wrote a poem called The Invitation.
Right.
But what I'd like for you to do is read a couple of paragraphs because it opens up your chapter on burning in love's fire. And I got to tell you, when I first got the book and thumbed through it, I went right to that because Rumi.
That was the chapter.
Well, Rumi talks a lot about, you know, burning and fire, the love's fire. And so that really attracted me to there. But I'd like for you just to read those two paragraphs, if you would. And sometimes when I have a singer-songwriter come on, like Janice Ian or whoever, I'll play a song and I'll have them give a backstory. I'd love for you to read those two paragraphs and then share your interpretation of what that is.
Is this the part that goes sometime
yes.
to cleans your house
yes.
gently?
Yes.
Okay.
And in my book, it's page 133.
Oh, is that right? On my book, it's 244. Oh, well, you're reading from the place where I used it in the chapter. I have the whole poem in the back.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what's on 244.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah. So I'm using she for a pronoun for God, but of course God is not he or she.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yes.
Sometimes she cleans your house gently, dismantling it room by room. But often she just comes in with a torch, and you feel in your gut the fire burn in the center of your separate comfort. And you watch the contents of your house melt and turn to ash and the roof blow off. And just when you think there's nothing more that she could take, she opens the ground beneath the barely intact shell of your house, and all the levels of your being fall into the space that has no name. And you are left alone in all the world, without a map, without a path, without a point of view. So that's not a big happy invitation, is it, that part?
And that's the point, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Yes.
It is. That, you know, if we want to be able to embody the deepest realization, we have to be emptied of all that we're not.
Yeah.
You know, not that we're not honoring this human expression. It's a beautiful expression of this mystery. But the ways that we have identified ourselves, the way we've stayed separate from all kinds of things and people and even parts of ourselves, love, from my perspective, just comes back for all of that as this process continues. And, you know, sometimes you actually can feel in my experience, you can just feel a burning sensation, you know, in the body, the heat in the body, as some of these things were sort of just burning up. And it's its own process. It's not like, well, I have to figure out how to do this. If we're really sincere in wanting the truth of life, of ourselves, whatever, then I think that these things will happen as they need to happen for any of us. And we don't have to look to someone else's experience and say, well, that should be mine, because each of us has our own unique unfolding.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yes, because oftentimes when people think about love or even burning love, they're thinking about a Hallmark card moment.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about here is an obliteration of everything.
Yes.
Yeah. She opens the ground beneath the barely intact shell of your house. Wow.
Well, and that was actually an experience where just everything fell out the bottom. I mean, in Zen, we'll call it, you know, the bottom falling out of the bucket, you know, where you think that you're all contained in this body, you know, and maybe you've experienced the vastness, but it's always sort of something outside the body. And then when that vastness or the mystery begins to make itself known in the body, you know, you realize, wow, I'm just not who I thought I was.
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of things fall away. And then the things that haven't, You know, I think love just comes back for whatever we've not been able to love or to see or to realize is here to, mm-hmm. to come back into the fullness of being.
Yeah. Is that what you mean by, because in this chapter that's advice you give for people, and that is become the burning.
Yeah, because anything that's uncomfortable, you know, and understandably, we're trying to get away from, but in this process, it's almost the other way around. I mean, it's not like you're letting a bus run over you or anything, but it's like there's going to be pain because our egoic identity does not want to lose its illusion of being the Godhead. Do you know, ego is a lovely servant. It just doesn't happen to be a very great master, even though a lot of our conditioning is on trying to become a master in our mind. But there's an intelligence that's so much deeper than anything we can learn from books or whatever. And so, yeah, I think that what we don't need is just, you know, it gets to melt up, and sometimes it does feel uncomfortable because we're resisting. And so when you become the burning, you're not resisting the experience. And that's true of anything. If you become the anger, you become the feeling of jealousy, you become the energy of sadness, not the story, but the actual energetic experience, now we're no longer separating ourselves from it. We're no longer resisting it. And we're actually experiencing it without separation, and it just transforms things. It always transforms things. And we're not talking about expressing these feelings. We're talking about really caring for them by not pushing them away inside ourselves. And it's just, I think it was Jeff Foster who said something, you know, like, you know, we all have these little children parts that are knocking at the door, you know, and we hear the knock, and then we open it, and then we say, "Not you again," and slam the door in their face, you know. But this open love, you know, it wants everything back home, and so it invites in a lot of things that we wanted to have kept out, frankly.
Yeah.
And that's challenging at times.
Yeah, I think I've heard Jeff Foster also say, stop trying to heal yourself and fix yourself or fast forward your life.
Right.
I bring that up because in your book you also write about your husband's death.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who think awakened individuals are so awakened, they're devoid of being touched by grief or sorrow or anger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case.
Yeah, I would just like to point out the fallacy of that. What's awake is not touched by it, but our human expression of this is very touched by whatever touches it. And and some of the greatest suffering are people who maybe have had some very profound openings or actually authentic awakenings. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many levels of awakening, actually. But, do you know, and then they have this idea, well, because I've had this thought or this feeling, well, then that can't possibly be what I am. And so there's this self-judgment and a lot of suffering around that.
Yeah.
But actually, we just don't understand because the mind can't understand how it is that you can be both sad and not sad.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can be conflicted about something in your mind and completely at peace with it. In this deeper dimension of your being, until you've experienced it, it's hard to explain or describe or certainly understand. But it's that peace that you were talking about. It's here, no matter what's happening.
When I left the church, I did find a home, in a sense, as a hospice chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been about 15 years off and on, but 15 years total that I've served in that capacity. And I've learned a lot about, well, embracing the mystery, but I've also learned a lot about the grief process, and I'd like for you just to share a little bit. Gosh, you even mentioned at age 12 your mother passed away, but focusing also on your husband of so many years, what was that grief process like for you?
Well, it would be very, I mean, it was a very interesting experience after he passed. It was a peaceful death, and I had no question that he was fine, You know, what he was and what we are is fine.
Right.
You know, and death doesn't part us. So that was clear. But there would be these waves of grief like I had never experienced before. We had been married nearly 50 years and gone together all through college. So he, you know, was my best friend as well as my spouse. But there would just be these waves of grief, like it was almost archetypal, the felt sense, you know, but there was nothing in me that was trying to stop it or feel like it was wrong to feel that. And then I would be so surprised because they would just wash over, like the next minute you'd be back in the moment and things would be okay. And then there'd be another wave and another wave and another wave. It didn't have a, you know, time schedule that, you know, oh, you're supposed to be over this or that. You know, it's for each of us, it has its own way of being. Mm-hmm. But you know, if we didn't love, we wouldn't have any grief over losing a loved one. You know,
absolutely.
So it's an expression of love. Do you know? I mean, it can, you know, it can go on and be a problem for some people. But I think that the problem is usually that we're resisting the truth of what's here. And when we don't resist it, it just gets to be what it is. And it passes through, and maybe it comes back again. But, you know, there was a story about the great Tibetan teacher, Marpa, who you know, taught that life is an illusion, and it's a dream, and so forth. But his oldest son died, and one of his students spotted him weeping. And he went and said, "Master, you know, you tell us that this is all an illusion and a dream, but here you are weeping, you know, why?" And he said, "Yes, it is all an illusion. Then the death of the child is the greatest illusion of all." You know, we're playing our part, so to speak. You know, the divine is playing all the roles, and so sometimes it's the role of the grieving parent or the grieving spouse or the you know, the inspired musician or whatever. You know, and you just don't have to judge how life is moving. You know, it doesn't mean we don't have discernment. We do, but
yes,
that judgment that it should look a certain way is just a limitation.
And that reminds me of one of the myths that you talk about in a chapter called Myths of the Spiritual Life, and that is, if I were awake, life would always feel beautiful and peaceful.
Right.
Wow, good luck with that.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And I do think that, you know, part of what we're, at least, you know, around here, the you know, there's so much movement among spiritual teachers and seekers as well to really embrace these human manifestations, you know, rather than to say they shouldn't be here. You know, someone like Ramana Maharshi, for instance, he was an incredible example of, like, the absolute in human form. But that was his dharma. That was what he was here to do, you know, and we're here to be who we are. And so the more we can really see that the divine is living within us, as us, do you know, then there's an appreciation and an honoring of our uniqueness, our differences, and our struggles as well. Because when the heart opens, and you know this from, I mean, I'm sure working with in a hospice situation, when the heart is open, you are more open to suffering than you were before, because you're not trying to push it away.
Yes.
And you're no longer necessarily trying to fix it. You're just open to loving in that moment and bringing compassion to the suffering in whatever ways seem obvious.
So then that speaks to another point I wanted to ask. In your book, you write, having even a very authentic awakening does not necessarily guarantee maturity. There does seem to be such a lack of maturity out there. I find so many people just desiring what I call more and more of Holy Ghost goosebumps. They just want to feel good, right?
Well, yes. Yes, of course, we do. We run into that a lot. This idea that, you know, that somehow we don't want the truth nearly as much as we want to feel good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we start to want the truth more than we want our life to look a certain way, then truth really begins to reveal itself more and more. Until then, we're trying to fix the self, or we're trying to get somewhere else. We're trying to be in another moment. We're trying to get away from what's here. But when we see that this presence that we truly are, it's not trying to get away from anything. It's just present to the moment as it is. And then, you know, then we have a different relationship with just even our very ordinary life. To know that it's more and more the case that I hear anyway, that there's an honoring of expression, not just the absolute, but the relative. I mean, for me, it's like a single coin. You know, one side's absolute, one side's relative. We can't really separate them except by seeing. You know, but something's awake to
yes.
which side is up, moment
yes.
to moment. There
yes.
may be an experience of this vastness and peace and love that's beyond anything we might imagine. And then the next moment, you know, our baby's crying and needs their diaper changed.
It's called life, isn't it?
It's called life, you know, the fullness of life, the wholeness of life. It's dark and light and everything in between.
Well, and we each certainly need to be responsible for our inner work. To me,
yes.
that's our big work. And I'm wondering, for Dorothy Hunt, who's been on this journey for some time now, what does your inner work look like these days?
Well,
challenge.
Yeah, I think it's more and more as I get older to be in the body in a very ordinary way. I mean, I spent a lot of years kind of hanging out in the ether, so to speak, you know? and that was my interest, and that it brought me to the moment. But you know, the things that I had not valued as much, you know, it feels like I said earlier, love just comes back for everything. So, you know, it's about being in the body, being grounded, being willing to have the moments that are vulnerable, you know, in our human experience. And I think that just humbles us. It's not humiliating. It's just an ongoing movement to become more and more humbled by life itself. So as the body ages, it has more challenges than it used to. And how are we with that inevitability?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I just wanted to share very quickly I adore mystic poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite translators is Daniel Ladinsky.
Yeah.
And I came across yet another Hafez poem, and it reminded me of what your book really is about and the teachings that you have done for so many years. But the title of this is Tripping Over Joy. You might have read this before.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. What is the difference between your experience of existence and that of a saint? The saint knows that the spiritual path is a sublime chess game with God, and that the beloved has just made such a fantastic move that the saint is now continually tripping over joy and bursting out in laughter and saying, I surrender. Whereas, my dear, I'm afraid you still think you have 1,000 serious moves.
That's the mind, isn't it?
Yeah.
1,000 serious moves.
Yeah, well, the book is Ending the Search from Spiritual Ambition to the Heart of Awareness. The author is Dorothy Hunt. Dorothy, your website, I believe, is dorothyhunt.org. Is that right?
That's correct.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your time with me today and also for continually sharing your light in this world.
Well, thank you for sharing yours as well and for the invitation to be with you. So blessings to you and to every listener.
Once again, our website is dorothyhunt.org. We'll have more of the show, but first, here's a word from our sponsors and our newest Wellness Minute from Dr. Mary Grace Pinella.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Goddess Mountain Naturals crafts quality salves and balms intended to aid in healing and rejuvenation of the skin and body through properties provided by nature. The various salves help to moisturize your skin, soothe itching caused by bug bites and poison ivy. These salves have been found to ease pain from sore muscles and tendons and aid in the healing of cuts and scrapes. These are remedies that have been used for thousands of years. For more information, you can visit www.goddessmountain.com. That's goddessmountain.com.
Meditation is the subtle art of staying in control, no matter what. Bet you never heard meditation referred to that way before. It's true, and when you have a habitual meditative practice in your life, it becomes the way you respond to whatever situation you find yourself in. For instance, the experience of dental work, your previous reaction, tense up, psych yourself out, and be in pain. With meditation in place, the reaction becomes relax and focus on breath. Since all pain is perceived in the brain, by focusing on breathing, you diverted your brain away from the pain. Nope, this doesn't happen after just one meditation session, but it is possible after several months of meditating. As you meditate daily, you build your meditation muscle. The more you practice mindful breathing, the more it becomes second nature. To quote my current meditation teacher, Father Justin Bielitz, meditating for 5 minutes is good, 10 minutes is better, 15 minutes is great. For more information about Silva Meditation Method, call 317-545-0742.
Now, in closing, here's an encore segment of, I believe, the first interview I did with somebody I mentioned in the interview with Dorothy, and that is the great Coleman Barks, who's probably the most renowned translator of the Sufi mystic Rumi.
Well, Coleman, clearly in October 1244, the meeting with Shams changed Rumi's life dramatically.
Mm.
What took place there, do you think?
Well, that's that meeting, like maybe any meeting, was a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that there are several versions of it, but whenever two people... their eyes, the glance meets, there is an exchange of lineage, I think. That is, we share who we have loved and who has loved us through the eyes. And that seems to have happened with Rumi and Shams. There was a verbal exchange too, but whatever darshan means occurred, and they met in the heart. And that meeting just galvanized him into an artist, a poet who could speak or ask the questions involving incarnation.
And their relationship was so special that there was some jealousy.
Oh yeah,
from some of, I believe, Rumi's students.
Yeah, they went into this place they call Sobet, which is a conversation with about. Mystical subjects and mystical ways, and maybe it was silent, maybe it wasn't. But the rest of the community who had adored Rumi's teaching felt left out of that, and so there was jealousy. And we don't know what happened, but probably Shams was murdered by elements in the community, and his body. Hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And Rumi then began a grieving and looking for Shams, but he evidently got to the place where he realized that he was then the friendship, that they were somehow merged together, and that he didn't need to long for Shams anymore, that he was that friendship.
Mm-hmm.
In some mysterious way. And so, I say he brought that into the world of mystical awareness.
Through your...
I keep saying it's beyond religion.
Yeah.
And it is. It feels like it is. And it seems like it was then that all religions, organized religion, merged in Rumi's awareness, mm-hmm. that everybody came to his funeral, Christian, Jew, Muslim, and Buddhist and Hindu. Whoever was there came because he had deepened their own religion. He didn't necessarily want to abolish religions, but he was at a place that is the source of the religious impulse to praise and to grieve. That shows the depth mm-hmm. of being in this intersection mm-hmm. with the human and the divine, and that which organized religion tries to honor, but he thinks it divides us. That's what he doesn't like about organized religion, is that he thinks if you consider that there is an important difference between a Christian and a Jew and a Muslim and a Hindu and a Buddhist and a shamanist, if you think those are important religions, important divisions, then you are dividing yourself from your heart, dividing from the way you act in the world. Hmm. And that amazing statement in the 13th century, amazingly radical statement, is also radical now. You know,
very much.
You hardly say it without fear of being shot. But he said it with such gentleness and with such authority mm-hmm. in the 13th century, with the Crusades going across Anatolia and the Mongol hordes coming down, that they didn't kill him.
And what's amazing, he was born in a country that we now know as Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah. And they still love him. Mm-hmm. He evidently is the most listened to poet on the radio there. Hmm. Not much book commerce in Afghanistan, but they listen to him on the radio and they mm-hmm. read him. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Coleman Barks was the most listened to on the radio over there.
He is not. No.
Not to put you on the spot, but is there something you could recite for us?
Oh, let's see. A little quatrain. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Hmm.
What has his poetry done for you as an individual and in your own spirituality?
I think I'd have to let somebody else talk about that, but it certainly has a... It's like I've been in an apprenticeship mm-hmm. for 25 years, mm-hmm. Working on his poetry almost every day, and I'm just very grateful for whatever heart-opening work he has done for me, mm-hmm. In terms of the language, I'm not sure. I try to make him accessible mm-hmm. and at the same time elegant in some way that I feel he is in Persian.
Now, in your presentations, you weave your readings with music, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Music was always a part of Rumi's, he calls it listening, as mm-hmm. a kind of sama, a listening that goes on with the poetry, that you let it go deep and you listen to your own inner guide as you're hearing the poetry. The poetry is, he says it's dangerous. He says especially beautiful poetry is dangerous because you feel like you've had the experience and that the poetry is pointing toward. Mm. And the more skillful the poetry, the more dangerous it is because you will be fooled mm-hmm. into thinking you've had the experience when you haven't.
And that's today's program. I want to thank my special guest, Dorothy Hunt, for joining me, and I want to thank you also for joining us as well. Reminder that all shows are podcast on our website, richardbrendan.org. And so for engineer Aaron Duvall and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.